Good evening. This is Mae Brussel. This is part two of a program called World Watchers. And if you missed the first half, listen to the second. You can send for these broadcasts if you write to me. All correspondence should be self-addressed, stamped envelope. And if you're local or even if you're driving through and out of town, I'm enlisted in the telephone book, the only Mae Brussel, not Mabe, Mae, M-A-E, B-R-U-S-S-E-L-L. You can call and ask questions. And if you missed, as I say, the first part of the program or want a copy of this broadcast or the sheet that goes with it with the sources of information. Now, just to show or prove to you that I don't think the assassinations and the mass murders are anything new, we've known they've gone on for a long time. I just want to cite one article that was in the newspaper last week. It was called Ceremonies to Honor Will Rogers, and it was about the airplane crash that he had 50 years ago with Wiley Post. And the article from the Washington Times, August the 5th, said, the cause of the accident that killed Rogers and Mr. Post was never determined. And my father used to be on the radio every Sunday night in KHJ for years in Los Angeles, and I used to go down to the station with him. I liked to watch him do it. Maybe that's where I picked up the interest in radio work, but I wasn't conscious of it at the time. And the person that followed him on the air after his broadcast was Will Rogers. So we used to spend a lot of time together at the station before and after the broadcast. And we were taking a trip to Alaska. I was 13 years old. And that summer we were going up to the Arctic Circle, and we were going to take boats up there, which we did. And Will Rogers and his family were going to go and take the same trip. We were going to do it together. And then at the last minute, he decided that he would fly with Wiley Post, the famous pilot. And so he took this trip himself, August 15th, 1935. I believe we were up in Seattle. We took a train from Los Angeles up to Seattle when we just got word that he had been killed in that plane crash. Instead of going on the train with us in the boat, he took the plane. Years later, when I was helping a person, some of you know who it is, write a book, trying to help her write about her experiences in Hollywood, she was telling me about Howard Hughes and the competition of Howard Hughes with Wiley Post and how Howard wanted to be a hero and make the round-the-world record. And Wiley Post was his biggest competitor. It'd be interesting to look up the details of those flights and when Howard went around the world and did, in fact, win that contest. There was no more Wiley Post because Wiley was dead. And in the course of researching the life of Howard Hughes, I came across six or eight people that had untimely deaths, just as the news story this past week that Lyndon Johnson had ordered the death of Judge Marshall in 1961 or 62 because he would link Lyndon Johnson to organized crime or hanky-panky, not the crime syndicate so much as illegal activities of Bobby Baker and Billy Saul Estes, and he wanted to continue to be the vice president of the United States. If not, of course, we know what happened in Dallas, and he became president. But before Dallas, he had a history of wiping out. There was an earlier story about somebody that was killed, and then this story just 2 weeks ago about Judge Marshall, who in fact was murdered, and they tried to say it was suicide. Again, the medical reports in collusion with the murderers, the autopsy reports in collusion. So don't trust your medical examiner or what they say all the time. They give you a quick answer. So I found that people all around Howard Hughes were dying, young actors, actresses, people who competed with him. And I asked at the time, I said, are we writing a book about obituaries? And I could run down some of those names for you sometime, but one of those that was a competitor with Howard Hughes was Wiley Post. And just as Lyndon Johnson didn't want a judge to live because he may prosecute a case that would rub off on him, you can see the people do have motives and do get away with these things. And as this article said, in commemorating his death 50 years ago, the cause of the accident that killed him and Mr. Post was never determined. Now, talking about determinations and accidents or man-made accidents, there was a story August 19th of the Monterey Herald carried on the wire service from Cincinnati, study due of inmates injected with cancer. A New York medical center is attempting to find out what happened to 200 Ohio prison inmates who were injected with cancer cells 23 years ago. That would be 1962 that they were given this cancer. I call this the Jack Ruby cancer with a question mark, because 2 years, 3 years later, Jack Ruby would be an inmate and he would get cancer. And I'll do more about that in 1 second. At the request of Representative Willis D. Grattison, a representative of Ohio, they've asked Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center about what happened to those studies that they did. Chester Southam, a doctor now in Philadelphia, said he didn't think anything unusual happened to these men, but there's been no follow-up study, so they directed Sloan Kettering. Doctor had gotten between $300,000 and $500,000 from the National Cancer Institute, and some of you don't remember the early broadcasts I did on cancer 2 or 3 years ago when I said that William Donovan was one of the first civilians put on the National Cancer Institute right immediately after the end of World War II. And, of course, Donovan and his OSS and his links to SS Karl Wolf and Heinrich Himmler and the Nazis that got out through the riot line and into our universities and space agencies and so forth is notorious. So why have a super spy like Donovan going into the National Cancer Institute? And this was a question of injecting these people. 200 Ohio prisoner inmates were given cancer cells in 1962 and have never been followed up. And it just came out recently. Now, I always call Jack Ruby's quick death. If you want to die of 3 or 4 weeks of a cancer, that's a Jack Ruby. If you want a long one that takes 3.5 to 4 years, that could be Martha Mitchell or Ronald Reagan. Los Angeles Herald Examiner, Tuesday, January the 3rd, 1967. Jack Ruby dies, loses fight to cancer. Ruby was moved to the hospital, the Parkland Hospital, where he's been suffering from cancer since December the 9th. He died on January the 2nd, so the report was January the 3rd. That was his 3-week cancer. At the hospital, his illness was first diagnosed as pneumonia, and then cancer, which had spread into the lymph glands, the lungs, the pancreas, and they said surgery would do no good. His friend, the attorney Elmer Gertz from Chicago, came to see him. He said Ruby was 55 at Christmas, just before Christmas, and he looked like a man 80 years old. Another headline, Jack Ruby was, he told the family that he was inflicted with cancer. This comes out of Dallas, and interestingly enough, on the back of the story of cancer, this is January the 3rd, 1967, that he said he was given cancer in the prison. On the very back page of that paper, the Los Angeles Examiner, is a picture of Ronald Reagan smiling. This is the day that Jack Ruby died. Governor Reagan smiles as the legislature applauds him. He's honored by a Senator Burns and Mrs. Unruh. Now, Jack Ruby's the man who wouldn't extradite Edgar Eugene Bradley, who worked with the Klan, the Nazis, with Reverend Gale of the Identity Movement, with the Aryan Nations, Mr. Swift, who was the man behind the Aryan Nations and the Identity Group, and with Gerald L. K. Smith and the anti-Semites that were pushing Reagan to be president. And I can cite those later, but this is mostly about deaths now. But on the back of this is a Reagan smiling, and the same day it said, Ruby told his relatives cancer was inflicted. When Jack Ruby first learned he had cancer, he was convinced it was inflicted on him. He said the cancer germs were introduced into his system secretly somewhere in the Dallas jail. While he experienced difficulty in breathing early in December, he was taken to the hospital, and they said he had pneumonia. And he said there must have been mustard gas or something seeped into his cell, because the diagnosis was changed to cancer, and he knew that the germs and not the gas were used to murder him. He himself was convinced to the end that he was the victim of a conspiracy, and he told his family that he knew that something came to him in the jail, that he had the cancer. January the 2nd, 1967. Relatives believe Ruby lacked care in jail. The handful of relatives and lawyers who saw Jack Ruby just before he was admitted to Parkland Hospital with cancer believe he didn't receive adequate medical attention. Ruby was not taken to the hospital until Sheriff Decker expressed, this is Bill Decker, expressed grave concern about his condition after visiting him in the cell. He was transferred to the hospital one day before a private physician was called in by his brother and sister, who was supposed to see him. Then nobody could see him. They quick put him in Parkland Hospital and locked him up. Dr. John Callahan, the assistant county health officer, apparently saw Ruby frequently, but never examined him. He had never been examined since 1964 until December the 9th when Sheriff Decker came. He was having coughing problems in the jail and spells 2 months before he was taken to the hospital, and he was unable to keep food down most of the time, which could be a food poisoning with something just as the radiation was put into Karen Silkwood's refrigerator, obviously to rub off on food that she's going to eat. She's not going to eat the sides of the refrigerator, so it gets into the food. If she wasn't going to be killed by a car accident, she was going to be killed by something that they bothered to put. The Geiger count showed high incidence of radiation in her refrigerator. So he's captive inside the jail, and he starts vomiting. This article says almost everyone who saw Ruby during the last weeks agreed he looked very ill. The last weeks, but not until his sister, you know, wanted to handle it. Apparently, no one is willing to explain who was chiefly responsible for seeing that Ruby was given a more thorough medical examination or that he was transferred to a hospital where some specialists could treat him. Ruby's brother, Earl, who lived in Detroit, and his sister, Eva Grant, visited him December the 4th and 5th, and they thought he was seriously ill, and they asked for a private physician. They thought, at first, the doctor came, Dr. Callahan, thought he might have pneumonia, and as we found out, to our dismay, he happened to have cancer. Sheriff Bill Decker said, "It is Dr. Pickard's duty to permit inspection of the records, and they refused to make the medical records of Jack Ruby available." Now, here, Sloan Kettering and our government and the Medical Cancer Institute is working on 200 prisoners in 1962, and 5 years later, in 1967, Ruby is vomiting, and they tell him it's pneumonia, and then they locked up the records, and they said, "You can't see the records." They refused to make the medical records open. "You're not going to put me in the medical profession," Bill Decker said, and Dr. Pickard and Callahan said, "We're not going to let you see them." Pickard said, "It's up to us and the sheriff, and he, we're not going to make the medical records available. We don't have to keep any records. We only record what medication is given, so if he didn't get medication," but they don't record, of course, what's in his food. Ruby told one of his lawyers, Elmwood Gertz, he had not had a thorough examination since November 63 when he was jailed. "Looking back, it occurs to me that he was seriously ill." Looking back, he was vomiting and so forth, but he was put in for pneumonia. And as I say, the day that he died, January the 3rd, Ronald Reagan is laughing. There's an article about a planned invasion of Cuba with Rolando Masferrer in the same paper. He worked with the CIA and the anti-Castro Cubans in the plot to kill John Kennedy. He formerly was an aide to Mr. Batista of Cuba. And at that time, the House Select Committee on Assassinations was doing their work. Speaking of death, Rolando Masferrer was blown away on a ship, along with other people like William Sullivan of the FBI of Division 5, and John Rosselli and Sam Giancana, and Carlos Prio Siqueiras, the former president of Cuba, and George de Morenschild. There were a lot of murders at that time of primary witnesses. And here's Masferrer's name working with anti-Castro Cubans trying to kill Fidel Castro in 1967. And next to it is the smiling Ronald Reagan. Well, the man who wouldn't extradite, Mr. Bradley, who did work with the Nazis and who himself was supported by the Nazis and put into office as governor. Interesting obituary, not a murder, but a natural death of a man on in years, 85 years old. Max Cutler dies. This is in the New York Times, July 14th. He developed a treatment for brain tumors in 1930, a cancer expert. Dr. Max Cutler, one of America's early pioneers in the campaign against cancer, died in Camarillo, California. In 1920, he worked widely with cancer experts, 1920, that goes way back, on radiology and surgery research, and he worked on tumors at the Chicago Tumor Institute. He was the director until 1952. He was affiliated with the University of Chicago. He first made use in this country of a technique learned in Paris of concentration radiotherapy, maximum feasible radiation, where they implant filtered radium inside the brain and left for periods ranging from 24 hours to 21 days. In 1932, he and Dr. Loyal Davis, that is the stepfather and the staunch conservative, the close stepfather of Nancy Reagan Davis. He was a partner with Dr. Loyal Davis and presented a new treatment for the malignancy of brain cancer, working with Dr. Davis, who was a neurosurgeon. And, of course, I did broadcast going back last year on the chronology of Nancy Davis and Ronald Reagan, their relationship and their political. I'll have to do more next week on Nancy and Ronnie Errol Flynn in lieu of the article just this week. I forgot to mention that. Came out in the Sunday San Jose Mercury. Ronald Reagan, informer for the FBI against the communists. This is while he was working with pro-Nazi Errol Flynn, and the early proof that he was an informer has been coming out in the news. And so we'll do more on Nancy Davis and her father, who worked with Charles Willoughby from the Kriegs Academy in Germany, Mr. Wiedenbach, and General MacArthur, and in the Philippines. Her father is a doctor, worked with Willoughby, who comes to Dallas and is on the board of Young Americans for Freedom with Ronald Reagan. All of this, these shenanigans and interweaving of people is very important because of the politics of cancer. This was a man that worked with her daddy and experimented putting 21 days of radium into people's brains. You just wonder who he was putting that into and what they look like when they were through with 21 days of radium. He retired in Beverly Hills, California in 1979, the year that Joseph Mengele was supposed to have been buried. 79, that year will always jump at me now to see what was happening then. He just passed away but had a lot of experience with cancer. Another murder took place, an important political murder at Monte Carlo, just recently reported in the news as of July. The murder described as a Jean Le Carré thriller, which means intelligence, of course. A cloak and dagger drama is described in the Washington Times of Shahnawaz Bhutto, the son of the former president of Pakistan, the first elected prime minister, Ali Bhutto. He was representing a democracy. It didn't last very long, and his son was murdered in Monte Carlo. The family said he was poisoned. An autopsy was ordered, and of course it was passed up. The scandal in Monte Carlo has been going on for a month, and Mr. Zia has allowed the body to return to Pakistan to probably make peace with the Bhuttos, because it's easy to have a dead president-elect buried there than it is to deal with him while he's outside the country. His sister has gone back to Pakistan, the daughter of the late prime minister. She's standing a chance of jail or house arrest. She's been fighting that country ever since her father's unfair execution. And again, it was Henry Kissinger in our State Department that had arranged the murder of Bhutto so that drug dealer Zia could run Pakistan. And he's more heavily in drugs now than ever, and he's getting more money from the United States State Department. Now, the opposite side of that coin is the Shah's son. The same time that the Washington Times describes the death of Mr. Bhutto, killed in poison in Monte Carlo, a large article in the Washington Times, Reverend Moon's paper, the Shah's son, Reza Pahlavi, and his supporters plan for post-Khomeini regime. Now, the reason I think that these top generals and those people that I mentioned were sending the weapons to Iran is to get ready for a revolution. They're not really for the Shah, but for everyone that Shah gets. Khomeini gets. They're getting ready for the Shah's son to return back to Iran. We need that to make war against the Soviet Union. I've mentioned that before. So this article is a long article on he's getting ready to come into the post-Khomeini regime. This is a father that worked with his grandfather, with Adolf Hitler, his father having the Savak, the treacherous torture machinery, the collection of drug traffickers, assassination teams, and secret police. He wants to return to Iran, and the answer of why these people worked, David Atlee Phillips and so forth, worked so closely with and the Pentagon, with the people sending the weapons to Iran, is to get them there to get ready for the Shah's son to be there. So Shah's son is alive. Despite all the death threats and everything, you notice that he's still around. And Paul Saloccia and his gang are pouring over $6 million worth of weapons, he brags about, pouring weapons into Iran so that they'll be stashed away. Khomeini, if he sees $1 million worth, he thinks he's lucky. and the other 5 million are for the revolution. So Mr. Buto's son is dead, and the Shah's son is ready to come back, and the peace-loving child is dead in an airplane crash, and the warmongers continue, and the students from the military academy are cutting throats, and Rambo is selling tickets, and so it goes. Now, there's a very important article in the Los Angeles Times on the opinion page, August the 18th, a week ago last Sunday, by Thomas Powers. Now, Powers isn't a leftist, and I want to go over this as closely as I can for the time remaining. He's a man who wrote, the author of The Man Who Kept the Secrets, Richard Helms and the CIA. So in order to work with Helms, you have to have top secret clearances. Helms was also an advisor at Iran. In Iran, after he left the CIA, and most of you know the career of Richard Helms and his activities in the Central Intelligence Agency, and there are a lot of good books out about it. But he's writing about a problem which is out of control in the sense of foreign affairs, and it's out of control in the sense of domestic affairs. And it gets, again, to people like David Attlee Phillips and John Singh Laub, with their soldier of fortunes, their advisors to these military trainings for movies, to military coups all over the world. He writes an article, "The Control of the Contras is a Hazardous Illusion." And what Thomas Powers says is that Alan Dulles tried to convince John Kennedy to have a secret army organization, a private army. If we couldn't send our troops to kill Castro and go into Cuba, use our secret army organization. And he told him that if you deny them the chance to fight Castro, they might fight us. Now, that is a very revealing statement by Thomas Powers, that Alan Dulles is literally saying, we will have a revolution in the United States if you don't let them go and get Castro. Now, John Kennedy pulled back from the Bay of Pigs. Alan Dulles was a member of the Warren Commission. He was also the CIA director before Kennedy had removed him. He used his anti-Castro Cubans, his Russians, his Nazis, Clay Shaw with his links to Permandex and Borman in South America, and Marina Oswald from Minsk. Those networks, he used all of them, Division 5 of the FBI. Alan Dulles used them, and they were, in fact, a part of the plot to kill John Kennedy. And he was saying, if you don't let them go into Cuba, they will kill us, and they've killed Kennedy and a lot of people since, and also links to Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, and all of these various murders, and now to the survivalists and to the Charles Eng people and the Rambo mentality that are nesting all over the United States and throughout the world. Now, this article said the CIA created a massive army for Ronald Reagan. He put more money in with William Casey from OSS, a Knight of Malta, from his war experiences in World War II, right to Washington. He has created a massive army for Ronald Reagan. And what Thomas Powers says is that they're now advised by the National Security Council. And that's another scandal I could do an hour or two with you, and I'm sure you're seeing these articles. And they're now funded by private individuals and organizations. So we have created, out of the laboratory, like AIDS, we have created a cancer bigger than what Mr. Dean, John Dean, told Richard Nixon. There's a cancer on the presidency. And Power says to control this group, this triangle group, is an illusion. Three loose cannons are on the deck. And he cites them again, the Contras, the army that won't be willing to give up and call it a day. If the Contadoras say don't fight, if the South American countries say don't fight, they are going to be willing to kill every person in Nicaragua, every peasant in El Salvador, every Indian in Guatemala. The Contras are not going to stop, and any person who asks for a land reform or a privilege will be knocked out as a Soviet agent of some kind. The Contras have been formed. They are growth of the army that Alan Dulles blackmailed Kennedy. If you don't use them, they'll use us. And now it's time for them to come to us. The second group, the National Security Council, which he says have now got the taste of secret wars without kibitzing from Congress. And that is one of the primary things I've talked to you and shared on the radio for years, was the creation of the National Security Council. It doesn't matter what man you represent, who you elect in, he will be overridden because the so-called national security experts will say, we know. That's the argument for bringing a national security advisor in El Salvador with the Contras at this time. It was in the New York Times and other papers, a quotation, Congress doesn't know what should be done. These elected people have no power to stop this machinery because they've given them the funds and they've fallen for all this anti-Soviet propaganda. So the National Security Council. And the third is the private funding that goes into these private armies. Now, he didn't mention it, but one is Reverend Moon, with close ties to Taiwan, the World Anti-Communist League, the Vatican, the Knights of Malta, Casey, Alexander Haig, Vernon Walters, William Buckley, William Shakespeare, the armies of the Knights of Malta. Claire Luce is one. I can cite them over and again for you. I should update it, you know, who these people and remind you. William Simon, who's messing around with the financial affairs down in Brazil, where Neves was murdered. Vernon Walters also with his tentacles in Brazil there when the first military dictatorship was put in by the CIA. And Alexander Haig and J. Peter Grace with his links to Otto Ambrose and I.G. Farben and the Nazi extermination, mass extermination. Why would he wince now? So what you have are the fundings of what they call private groups, the pharmaceuticals and businesses. And Mr. Powers says the danger is that they will expect a reward from their grateful president, who's showing his, you know, this Mr. Mancha who came in from Grenada, who had Mr. Bishop murdered, and he will give them business and profits. And also, when they overthrow the countries and turn them into total dictatorships, they can take their profits again out of the bananas and the sugar and keep making the real Coke and the new Coke and the old Coke and the Pepsi generation and afford to give millions of dollars to promote the Pepsis and the Cokes, because they have raped these countries and starved these people and are making wars upon the native populations there. Now, Powers says this miserable but familiar mess is best understood as a constitutional crisis triggered by the inherent difficulties of running a global foreign policy in a democracy. He says when the governors and the governed do not fear the same things, so that those that governing us, Mr. McFarlane, and Mr. Weinberger, Caspar Weinberger, and George Shultz, and Henry Kissinger, and that gang, you know, when they get together, they decide what we need to do. Mr. Brzezinski is being brought back in to the White House just this past week. And Thomas Powers says, the plain fact is that the American people parted long ago on the subject of Soviet threats. And you see, when we want peace, that's just forget it. He's going to break up every peace conference. Reagan's doing it now. He said, we have parted. Foreign policy makers in Washington have been worried about the Soviet subversion for 40 years. And this goes back to the early deals, the meetings before Potsdam, where the top German Nazis were meeting with Alan Dulles of the Warren Commission, with John J. McCloy of the Warren Commission, with Henry Stimson, the former Secretary of War, a rabid anti-Semite, and with these multinational corporations. The Soviet threat is the thing that made them have a national security advisor. It was set up by Adolf Hitler's team, and it is the biggest threat to our country and to what is happening to us, because these people are beginning their murders in this country, wiping out the plane crashes, the death, the bunkers, the tortures, the airplane crashes, the links to the schools, the 12 schools or more of mercenaries, directly linked to possible atomic explosions and so forth. The Contras, the National Security Council, and the private funding have combined in a way that are responsible for these murders that go way, way back and up to the present time. The mentality of getting away with murders was done by private individuals also, like maybe Howard Hughes or Lyndon Johnson, who knew if somebody's in my way, just kill them. But the judges and the coroners went along with it. And once you begin to pile those bodies, the thing begins to smell. I have said over and over again, the Constitution, up till World War II, the 40 years ago that they're talking about, had the executive, the judicial, and the legislative balance it used to have. After World War II, Reinhard Gehlen was brought to this country. He and the top Nazis formed the National Security Council, which took all decisions from all elected members of Senate and Congress, And they decided in their heads, along with the top Gestapo chiefs of World War II and British intelligence, what is national security. This organization negated all congressional and presidential decisions and opinions, and the president takes vacation. The national security advisor's in the next room. If he's in a hospital, the national security advisor is there, or the chief of staff, Mr. Reagan, R-E-G-A-N, who then meets with the national security advisor. And then, to top it, with the Contras and with the national security and the private funds, people like retired generals such as John Singlaub appear, who has entree to the National Security Council, to the Knights of Malta, to the private funding, to the highest echelon of the military directing these affairs, and then he sets up a magazine with Robert Brown called Soldier of Fortune, and David Atlee Phillips sets up the Survivalist. So they mount their attack to prepare to get rid of us, those Rambos, when the time comes when there's no more battles in Central and South America. And the more they win, the meaner they get, and the more they lose, the meaner they get. And my time is up, so I can't continue this, but this is a sad time for this country. There are a lot of good articles and a lot of terrible stories, but the time is out now, so I have to stop, and I'll be back with you next week. This is Mae Brussel. You take care, and keep your spirits up if you can. Bye-bye.